WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. A little bit later in the program, we are going to be talking about the state of the medical marijuana business here in Illinois and a bit about how some restaurants are trying to take more eco-friendly measures in their business, and all about a security flaw that's allowed some people with diabetes to bypass the costly insulin delivery business. That is all coming up on the program, but right now we are joined by Josh Noel, who is a beer writer at the Chicago Tribune and author of Barrel-Aged Stout and Selling Out, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. Josh, hello. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Amy. Glad to be here.
So talk to us about this, because this is a really interesting company in particular when we're looking at Anheuser-Busch, because 10 years ago, they were not in the craft beer business. We knew them for just their kind of regular stables of big popular beers, and in a very short period of time, they made a lot of purchases, and it seems like that's really changed the face of the company.
Well, it's changed the face of the company. And it's changed the face of the craft beer industry. 10 years ago, Anheuser-Busch was starting to see some pretty serious declines in its most core portfolio, which we know is Bud and Bud Light, pretty much, and, you know, Natural Light and Busch, some of those things. And people just don't drink those beers like they used to. And craft beer was ascendant, and Anheuser-Busch was sort of messing around at the edges of craft beer. It was trotting out craft beers under the Michelob banner, but that had no resonance. Craft beer drinkers didn't want to reach for a Michelob beer. They wanted a true, authentic, oftentimes locally made craft beer with fresh ingredients. And Anheuser-Busch realized that this, in some ways, was part of where the beer industry was headed. So they did what the biggest companies do, and they got their M&A guys all primed and ready to go, and went coast to coast and bought a bunch of craft breweries, the kinds of brands that they could never create themselves effectively. They wound up buying, and they bought 10 of them, and got at there, they've become an incredibly large craft beer player as a result of these 10 acquisitions.
And what about other big beer companies that are in that space? Are they kind of playing by the same rules, and is it getting contentious, or is AB really kind of leading here?
Both is really the answer. So Miller Coors, which is based here in Chicago, has bought, it's either four or five craft breweries of their own. Constellation Brands, which is mostly a wine company, but also owns the Corona and Modelo brands in the U.S., so they are also a sizable beer company. They've bought a couple of a few craft breweries at this point. So Heineken, of course, bought Lagunitas, which has a big brewery here in Chicago, and those are all big beer companies for sure, and they are also buying their way into craft beer. However, no one has undertaken such an aggressive and comprehensive strategy as Anheuser-Busch. And that is traditionally the posture Anheuser-Busch has had in the American beer industry. Miller is big, but Anheuser-Busch is much, much bigger. So Anheuser-Busch is really affecting things very differently, even though those other large companies are getting involved.
And as the title of your book suggests, Barrel-Aged Stout and Selling Out, is there that narrative of kind of with the small craft beer makers of kind of this decision of selling out, or are fans kind of disappointed when they do get bought, or what happens to their story then?
Yeah, that's a great question. And story is actually a key word, and that's part of what Anheuser-Busch can't build on its own. It doesn't have the story behind the brands. Craft breweries, these smaller breweries, they have the story. And the story is profoundly affected when one of these breweries sells. Things have died down, for instance, for Goose Island here in Chicago. They sold in 2011 to Anheuser-Busch. They were the first of the 10 breweries to sell to Anheuser-Busch. And people screamed sellout. People said, I'll never drink Goose Island again, all that kind of stuff. And they've probably lost a very small corner of their previous clientele. But Goose Island has grown wildly since Anheuser-Busch acquired it. And so the stigma of quote-unquote selling out, it doesn't quite hover around Goose Island so badly anymore. However, the most recent brewery to sell to Anheuser-Busch, Wicked Weed Brewing, the reaction that just happened in 2017, the reaction was fierce. And if you go on Wicked Weed social media channels, whenever they post something like, hey, here's this new beer we have coming out, the replies will be sellouts. Mm-hmm. Why don't you just put some Bud Light in your tanks instead? That kind of stuff. So it really continues to dog that brand. So what the breweries mean to their customers definitely profoundly changes once they sell, and especially once they sell to Anheuser-Busch.
Right. And so, well, but that gets at kind of another question, and that is, when these acquisitions are made, do they become manufacturing partners, or is it mostly about marketing and operations and distribution?
It's all the above. Distribution is really, that's the biggest thing, and that was the hardest thing to write about in the book in a way that was engaging to a reader, but accessible, or, you know, engaging and accessible, but also the proper deep dive into what's a very multi-layered subject. But in some ways, Anheuser-Busch needs these brands just because they need sort of that credibility in that part of the craft beer industry. But others, so like you, for instance, you still see all sorts of Goose Island beer produced here in Chicago. That is truly made by Goose Island and is not made in particularly large batches, let's say. However, Anheuser-Busch has also taken about a dozen Goose Island brands and is now making them in the same tanks as Bud and Bud Light and rocketing them across the nation from coast to coast. For instance, Goose Island IPA, which you'll see at, you know, in most stadiums and most airports and most sports bars. I mean, it's everywhere now. And that's because Anheuser-Busch is making it, on a very large level right now. So it's both. Anheuser-Busch needed major league plays, things that they could, sort of comprehensively cover the country with, such as Goose Island IPA. But they also need the small scale credibility, that really sort of defines craft beer, local, fresh, things like that.
Is there a sense of a shift? Is it even fair to really call some brands craft beer then at some point?
Yeah, no, that's a great question too. There is very much a war over what does craft mean? What does independence mean? So I think there's an argument to be made that the beers Anheuser-Busch is making through its craft breweries, you can call that craft beer. It's competing against craft beer. It was grown organically as craft beer. However, the Brewers Association, which is the trade organization for 4,000 of the nation's small, independently owned craft brewers, well, mostly small, they have a definition of craft brewer, and they do not consider the beer that the Anheuser-Busch companies are making as a legitimate craft beer based on the ownership of the breweries. So this is, and it's very, and people are critical of the definition. Some people are very appreciative of it, and other people are critical of it. So there's no one answer. On one hand, yes, it is in the spirit of craft beer. It competes in the market as craft beer, but does the ownership mean it is no longer truly craft? Some people make that argument, and, you know, I think both sides make sense.
Right. It seems with kind of the social media narratives that emerge when these acquisitions are made, I think there's maybe an expectation in the public that there needs to be a grassroots component. I think people want to kind of like root for the underdog, something like that. Well, very interesting stuff. Who knew big beer was so very contentious? Josh Noel, thanks so much for being with us. Beer writer at Chicago Tribune and author of Barrel Age Stout and Selling Out, Goose Island, Anheuser-Busch, and How Craft Beer Became Big Business. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amy.
All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to be talking a bit about how restaurants and other food service venues are trying to embrace the eco-friendly movement. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Always grateful to you for that. Coming up on the other side of news after 12:30, we're going to be talking a little bit about the state of the medical marijuana business in Illinois and how, although it might be kind of growing very slowly, much slower than anticipated, there's still a lot of investment going on, and we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about a security flaw that has allowed some people who depend on insulin to receive it in a very different, interesting kind of DIY sort of way. But before we do that, we are joined now by regular contributor to this program, Bridget Sweeney, reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, who wrote about Chicago restaurants and caterers embracing eco-friendly practices and how that impacts their business. Bridget, hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Always a pleasure. So, you know, we had to see this coming, and in fact, I think it's almost surprising it hasn't happened sooner, but I think it's interesting on the heels of the straws conversation. We've been talking about, I think, the last 3 weeks on the program, the straw debate has come up in our conversation, and this seems like yet another logical step that consumers would really be demanding their food service providers be making some pretty bold and serious and meaningful steps in the eco direction.
Absolutely. And so without delving too much into the straw, you know, kind of debates and controversy, it's the one thing it has going for it is that it's a discreet, concrete step mm-hmm. that you can take, and it's simple. That does not go for composting, et cetera, inside the restaurants at the consumer level. Obviously, we probably have all been in, I'm trying to think of places in Chicago, it's Sweetgreen, there's a few others where, you know, you go to the garbage can and you can compost stuff or you can throw stuff away. And they try and make it simple, but I always see someone throwing, you know, a Starbucks cup into the compost. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's not compostable. So that introduces the whole world of quote-unquote post-consumer struggles for these caterers and these restaurants to implement these really eco-friendly practices, because they do require education, they do require habit change and, you know, behavior change.
Yeah.
So that said, a lot of places have had a lot of success with pre-consumer changes like this, which means the cooks and the chefs and the prep people do all this work, and then therefore the caterers and the restaurants can control it a lot more easily. They just have different bins in each workstation where you toss all the food scraps, you toss everything, and then they work with third-party composting companies to come and collect the bins and actually, you know, compost it. So that works really well, and that's something that obviously can really significantly decrease both carbon emissions and just food waste.
You wrote in particular about food for thought, and again, for those who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out after the program so you can read it for yourself. You note some interesting steps, and that's composting about 50 tons of food scraps and converting pounds and pounds and pounds of cooking oil into biodiesel. Is that something that is within reach for most food service operations? Is that costly? What does it take to do that and train employees to get in the habit of those steps?
Absolutely. So after speaking with Food for Thought, CEO Nancy Sharp, you know, Food for Thought, for people who aren't familiar, I wasn't actually very familiar, but they are a really, really big caterer in the city. They've been around for 3 decades. They do a lot of galas for a lot of the big museums and nonprofits. They do individual catering and parties. So they have a pretty significant commitment to these practices. It does cost more. That said, it may not cost as much as you think it would. If you're doing it just in your kitchens and just in your facilities and not introducing it to the actual consumer, you can work with third parties. Food for Thought works with Collective Resource, which is based in Evanston. Their point is, you know, you're going to be hauling away food waste no matter what. So you're going to be paying a waste hauler to take it away and dump it in a landfill. It will cost more, but not markedly more, to work with a composter. But once you get onto the consumer end of things, it does require significant investment in order to really make that go all the way through down to the down to the, you know, what we see on the consumer side of things.
You mentioned also McDonald's and Starbucks, which, you know, I don't think are two brands that people really think of when they think of, you know, food service providers perhaps leading in this space and thinking of this green mindset. In particular, I'm thinking there must be a ton of straws and drink lids and all these components. And so what are they saying in this conversation?
Right. Well, Starbucks has agreed to eliminate them by 2020, which frankly, when you think about just how dependent Starbucks products are on straws, that's pretty remarkable. Even if it's not imminent, it's at least fairly soon. You may have already seen, I think they test them on some of the cold brew coffees and some of their nitro coffees, the lids that don't require a straw. You know, it's almost like an adult sippy cup. So, and those are biodegradable. Because at first I was like, well, how is that any better? But that's the scoop on those. So you'll be seeing those more and more at Starbucks. McDonald's has been pretty straightforward about the fact that they don't have any good straw solution that can handle the mass quantities that McDonald's customers use. Apparently they use 60 million straws every single day. And a lot of these paper and other, you know, bamboo suppliers are not that big. So they are testing some products in Ireland, in the UK, in non-US markets, and they are now saying that they will start testing some more straw alternatives in the US later this year in certain markets.
It is all really interesting stuff. And again, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out so you can read it for yourself. We will keep turning to you for the latest as more companies wrestle with what it means to be eco-friendly. Bridget Sweeney, reporter at Crain's Chicago Business, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Amy.
You bet. Okay, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're joined now by Ali Marotti, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, and of course, regular contributor to this program, who wrote an update on the state of medical marijuana companies in Illinois and says that they are growing despite relatively low demand. Ali, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Amy, thanks for having me.
Certainly, always a pleasure to have you on. And so, you know, last time we were talking about the medical marijuana industry here on the program, all signs pointed to a lot of really low growth, and it just wasn't taking off the way people really anticipated it doing, and there was a lot of red tape involved and all that. But it seems like even though that is the case, investment is being made and growth is happening on the front end, even if it's not happening on the consumer end.
Yeah, that's true. It's been really interesting change of pace in the past just like 7 months, you know. Basically what we're seeing happen now is that the patient count is growing. So we're seeing a lot of expansion. Construction is underway now to accommodate growth, just in the number of people that are gaining access to the drug, you know. And then kind of looking forward, which these companies have to do because it takes, you know, 9 to 12 months to complete construction on a cannabis facility. They're looking at what could happen if Governor Rauner signs this opioid bill that's sitting on his desk right now. Because if that happens, the program could expand very quickly and very vastly.
And, you know, there's really a very interesting narrative around that bill because a lot of people, even people who aren't necessarily advocates of medical marijuana, are saying, hey, I think this could bypass a lot of people that are going the opioid route and we could save a lot of lives this way. And is there any other, you know, are there any other big debate points that you're seeing around that?
Yeah, so that's a lot of what I'm hearing. So the bill, just to tell you a little bit more, would allow medical marijuana to be used in place of prescription painkillers. So if your doctor assigns you or prescribes you an opioid, you know, you're eligible to get medical marijuana. And, you know, Illinois officials have declared the opioid crisis one of the greatest health crises in Illinois. You know, there's the state's prescription monitoring program tracked 1.5 million opioid prescriptions just in the first quarter of 2017. What that equates to is more than one opioid prescription for every 8.5 Illinois residents. So that's it. But, you know, there's speculation that even if he does veto it, the House and Senate could override that veto. So a lot of the growers here in the state are pretty optimistic that will get passed. It's just a matter, they say, of how it will be implemented once it does. And it does two other big things, too, besides the opioid portion. Right now in Illinois, to get access to medical marijuana, you have to do fingerprints and get a background check. And a lot of people argue that that really draws things out, you know, that it involves a lot of bureaucracy with the fingerprinting. People are having to wait a really long time to hear whether they're approved or denied. And then what I'm hearing is that a lot of people, you know, say you're an 80-year-old man who, you know, has cancer now, but maybe when you were 20, you got caught with a little bit of weed and that's on your record, you could be denied for the program. So, you know, they're saying that if those two things go away, it would be really huge for increasing access to the program for people. So there's kind of a lot of like interesting things that could happen if Rauner does end up signing that bill.
Yeah, and even with the background checks that you mentioned, it seemed to be that there was a lot of conversation around the length of time, in particular for people with a potentially terminal illness or, you know, any kind of very, very serious illness, like that need to manage pain right now today, waiting months and months to get this, you know, background check and all this paperwork cleared was time that they didn't really necessarily have.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I've heard stories about people whose, you know, loved ones have died before they've been able to get their medical marijuana card. So there is a provision in place now that allows people with terminal illnesses, you know, to have the process set up for them. But, you know, sometimes that still doesn't happen. You know, the state, I know that they work very hard to get people approved and they work as fast as they can, but sometimes there's only so many people that are able to do that and that sort of thing. So there's something similar built into the opioid bill too, where it would be expedited approval. So yeah, I mean, hopefully that can be taken care of too, because it is a huge problem that I've heard from a lot of people out there they run up against. And you know, I've heard anywhere between like 90 to 120 days people are having to wait. And that's much more than the law is written now that says it should take. So.
You also note in the story, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program so you can read it for yourself. There's really interesting information in there. But there is a note in the story about financing issues connected to the medical marijuana industry that is really interesting and one of those things you don't really think of until you read it. And then you go, oh, of course that's an issue. Of course it is. And that is how Bank of Springfield pulled out of the industry, and banks kind of want to be distanced from it. And so a lot of startups in this space have to deal with, you know, with a cash operation, which is very, very tricky to growth, of course.
Right, for sure, yeah. So the main bank serving the Illinois medical marijuana companies, Bank of Springfield, like you said, they pulled out of the industry last spring. And that decision was triggered by the reversal of an Obama-era policy that discouraged prosecution of those operating under state marijuana laws. So basically, this is still an illegal drug in, you know, the eyes of the federal government. If a bank is dealing with a company that's operating in marijuana, they could take the look that this is drug money, you know. So the Bank of Springfield, I think, got worried about that, pulled out, and a lot of these companies have had to just deal in cash, or, you know, sometimes they're able to find a smaller bank somewhere in the state that will help them out. So they figured that out. And then the other thing that has happened is that, you know, up until just the past couple months, they had to get really creative with freeing up capital. And that was something that we talked about, you know, last time you and I we spoke about just this industry, was that there weren't enough patients in the program. There weren't enough people buying marijuana in Illinois to recoup the investment that some of these companies made to get up and running here. You know, they had to put in hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, just to get their businesses off the ground. And the program was, the law was written and the program was built to grow faster than it has, you know, but things just didn't work out that way for a number of reasons. It didn't grow as fast as everybody thought that it would. The number of qualifying conditions didn't expand like it was originally intended to. So they had to get creative. You know, there was one company that looked at selling their buildings that they were in and then leasing them back just to free up some capital. And then there's a company here called Green Thumb Industries. And they actually went public on a Canadian exchange just a couple months ago, and that was able to get them a bunch of capital. And I talked about them in the story, too. I spoke with their founder. You know, and now they have all this extra money that they can put into expanding their facilities, hiring more people. And then the other thing that did was just show investors the value, you know, of a marijuana company, because until then, it hadn't really been, people weren't sure, you know. So I think that institutional investors and investors just aren't as worried about getting into the space now. So now these companies are getting more access to money, and they have, you know, more wiggle room to operate and expand their business.
Yeah, it also seems like this is going to be an interesting topic, particularly as you know, the next step in this conversation is usually the one beyond medical use and into recreational mm-hmm. use and legalizing it. And it seems that that's going to play an interesting role in the upcoming gubernatorial campaigns.
Mm-hmm, yeah, absolutely. J.B. Pritzker, who's the Democratic contender, has said that he would work to legalize recreational marijuana. So that's something that a lot of cultivators are thinking about, you know, because if that happened, it would be crazy expansion, and then it's just a matter of logistically figuring out, okay, how are we going to be able to grow that much weed, you know? So they are thinking about that.
Right, Raul, very interesting stuff, and we will keep turning to you for the latest as it continues to unfold. Ali Marotti, business reporter at Chicago Tribune, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a security flaw that has allowed some people with diabetes to bypass a very costly insulin delivery business. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. We're grateful to you for that. So we are joined now by Michelle Cortez, who is the health science and medical technology reporter at Bloomberg, who wrote about a $250 biohack that is totally revolutionizing the lives of some people with diabetes. In particular, it is really changing about like how people are dealing with this $8.3 billion insulin delivery business, which is a really tricky thing. It's difficult to think about that being, you know, $250 changing someone's life so dramatically, but nonetheless, this is a really fascinating story. Michelle, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Absolutely.
This story is so very interesting because when we think about health, in particular, cobbling something together to replace or you know, subsidize the work that a pancreas is doing, that seems a little terrifying. It seems like a lot, and yet a lot of people have done this and are really finding kind of a workaround to just an easier way of life, it seems.
It's absolutely terrifying for folks like us who don't have diabetes, but the truth of the matter is that people who have been dealing with it all of their lives or all of their children's lives, they say to us when we were reporting the story that we're doing this all the time anyway. Every day we have to adjust to how much insulin we're giving, test, and are in control of that. So, you know, I would rather have it be a program and a computer that I wrote, a program that I wrote on my computer when I had all my facilities going, as opposed to something I was just like backhanding in the middle of the night for my 3-year-old.
Right. And so how does this work? What is it that people are creating to make this hack?
Well, so first you have to understand a little bit about how diabetes works, which is, of course, the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas are destroyed for people with type 1 diabetes, and so they have to inject themselves with insulin. And in order to know the right amount, they have to do calculations and tests. And so what this community has done is they've taken all of the devices that diabetics currently use, like the machines that tell them what their glucose levels are and the insulin pumps that pump out the right amount of insulin that they have told the insulin pump to pump out, and just connected them all to each other so that they don't actually need to have the person telling them what the glucose is. The glucose monitor speaks to the insulin pump, and the pump speaks back to the monitor, and there's not a person involved any longer.
And I know there's some apps that kind of do some of this calculation for people and that kind of thing. How does that fit into this whole thing?
There are apps that do that, but what this does is it takes it all off of the person's responsibility, the patient or the patient's parents, whoever is doing the adjustment, and has it happen automatically. There aren't apps that actually tell a patient what to do. You have to calculate the insulin amount to give. And what the apps do is allow people to actually see what their glucose level is on a moment-to-moment basis so that they can do the calculation themselves or tell them how much insulin they've given so that they know how to adjust going forward. But the whole automation of the process is what's new.
Mm-hmm. And you write it in the story, which, again, I will share on social media after the program so that you can all read it yourselves. It is so interesting. But the story opens with a family that you profile, in particular, exactly how doing this changed the lives of this family who, here's this mom who was waking up every couple of hours to give her daughter, you know, test her blood sugar, give her insulin, all these things. And so this is really, in a sense, kind of given them a sense of normalcy and let this woman sleep through the night and this kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goes back, speaks again to how completely all-absorbing diabetes can be, especially type 1 diabetes. You know, that is, insulin is a life-saving drug. You have to have a specific amount. You have to have it regularly. And boy, when you are a newly inducted family into this, you know, diabetes group that nobody really wants to be part of, you have a huge learning curve. And part of that learning curve is dealing with the terror of knowing that your child or yourself can, you know, fall into a coma, can die, God forbid, can, you know, years down the road have heart disease or lose a limb or lose their vision because the disease hasn't been controlled well from the beginning. And so it can just completely swallow your entire life.
And is there a product on the market now that this many people are kind of doing this DIY? I have to assume companies, and in particular in the pharmaceutical and medical, you know, biotech space, are thinking maybe there's another way to do this, or something they could make money off of, or something like that. Is there any design that you're aware of to do something like that?
There is, actually. Medtronic sells a device called the 670G, and it actually works very similarly to what the DIY community is doing. And in fact, in certain areas, it's much easier. It's more, you know, you buy it, you get it through your insurance, it arrives in a box, it's very simple to set up. You have somebody who is a navigator who helps you set up the system. But the system, and it's been available for about a year now, and 100,000 Americans have already, or not Americans, 100,000 people have already used the system. It's only approved in the U.S. so far, so we're assuming most of them are Americans. But so there is a huge demand for this, and it is a big product for Medtronic. The thing that's different about that, though, is that when you're sending someone a box, you have to send everybody the same box, and it sets up the same way, and it goes for the same insulin levels, the same blood glucose levels or the targets. It's the same for everybody. The DIY community, there's about 2,000 people as opposed to 100,000. But those 2,000 people build the system themselves. That's the thing that's key. These are parents and patients who nights and weekends have put this together themselves and tailor it specifically to their exact needs. So if you are a brittle diabetic and you need really tight control, you can specify it that way for yourself. If you are somebody who wants to have a little bit more leeway because you don't want to, you know, feel unwell and maybe be lightheaded, so you want to give yourself a little bit higher blood sugar for a while because you're not worried about the long-term consequences while you're doing a run on a ski slope or giving a presentation that you're nervous about, then you can adjust on a day-to-day basis or moment-to-moment basis, whereas the Medtronic 670G product is a little bit more mainstream for everyone.
Right. Really, really very, very interesting. And again, I'm going to share this on social media after the program so that everyone can read it for themselves. It is so very interesting. Michelle Cortez, health science and medical technology reporter at Bloomberg. Thanks so much for being with us and talking about this story today.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. All right. We are going to take a little break and come back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.